Yep, that's one of my favorite bands from my formative years, Blue Oyster Cult. And no, I don't think they need more cowbell. I grew up on the Beatles, and then I transitioned as a teenager into the world of progressive rock. My two favorite bands were Yes and Genesis with Peter Gabriel. The complexity of that music and its classical influences always fascinated me, as did the new types of instrumentation, synthesizers, multiple keyboards, guitars. Recently, I saw an iteration of Yes called ARW for the members John Anderson, Trevor Rabin, and Rick Wakeman. And Yes, and our many members, eight of them at least, are being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I started watching lots of covers of Yes music by talented musicians and saw how much they were influenced by 70s progressive rock. That's when I stumbled onto the Band Geek podcast. And our guest, Richie Castellano, plays bass guitar and keyboards for Blue Oyster Cult and is the creative force behind the Band Geek podcast. You can find links to it on our website, mynspr.org. So let's get right to our interview with him. Joining us now via Skype, Richie Castellano, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to know about how you came to the attention of Blue Oyster Cult, which is one of my favorite bands from my kidhood when I was a teenager.
It actually all starts from my grandmother's music store. My grandmother had a music store for over 40 years in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and it was called Bath Music. And for anyone who lived in that area of Brooklyn, the store was legendary. You know, the stories that came out of that store are incredible. And when I say that it all started there, one of their loyal customers was a kid that lived in the neighborhood by the name of Steve Lacera. And he was a drummer in a metal band and basically loved my grandparents and was a part-time employee at their store and just a great guy. And he went on to become an audio engineer, and he turned out to be, or ended up being, Blue Oyster Cult's front of house engineer. His name is Steve. We call him Woody. So it's Steve Woody Lacera. And I sort of kept in touch with him because he knew that I was also interested in audio engineering. And I went to college for audio engineering. I went to Purchase College in Purchase, New York, and I studied music production and composition. And he sort of kept that in his mind that I was studying that sort of thing. And years later, I was 20, so this is 2000. He was doing, while he was working for Blue Oyster Cult as their sound man, he also was writing for, at the time, I believe it was EQ Magazine as one of their, you know, and that's an audio engineering magazine. And he was, you know, one of the contributing writers and editors. And he had to go cover, I believe, a big audio conference. And BOC didn't have a sub for him. And it was sort of like a last minute thing. Oh no, what are we going to do? Who are we going to get to do sound? And then I was in college living in the dorms, and he called me and he said, hey, what are you doing this weekend? I said, nothing. I think I have to, you know, mix a wedding for my dad. And he said, well, how would you, you know, feel about mixing front of house sound for Blue Oyster Cult? And I said a bunch of words that I can't say on this program. And I agreed to it. And I basically, for the next 3 years of that, became his sub for Blue Oyster Cult. And I really liked those guys, and I think they liked me, and we got along really well, and I had a blast just doing sound for this band. And they took me, my first time going overseas was with Blue Oyster Cult. They took me to Germany for 3 weeks. It was one of the greatest times they ever had, just doing sound and hanging out with the guys. And that's how I got involved with them. And then 4 years after that, their bass player, Danny Miranda, who actually is part of my podcast now, he got a call from Brian May of Queen to go play their Las Vegas musical, and he didn't want to turn that down. So he had to leave Blue Oyster Cult on very short notice, and the guys in the band knew that I played bass as well as guitar. So they gave me a call with 4 days' notice saying, hey, can you cover these two gigs this weekend? And, you know, here's 20 songs to learn. And I did it, and that was my first gig, and that was almost 13 years ago.
Let's get into some of the technical stuff, because that's what most fascinates me about talking to you is, you know, when I was growing up, everything sounded very futuristic. You know, I would go see Yes, and the Moog synthesizer was a new thing. But, you know, at that time, you know, even though things sounded futuristic, that was all analog. And now, you know, we've gone through the digital age. Could you just give us, you know, as briefly as you can, that history of transition from analog to digital, from what they could do then to what you can do now?
Well, I can tell you my experience with it. I had my first recording setup was analog. I got my first recording setup when I was maybe 12 years old. My uncle had, he was a hobbyist, a recording hobbyist, and had a lot of gear. And he gave me what a lot of people started on, which was a four-track cassette recorder. And that was a great starter device. And I almost think it's now with the digital accessibility, how any kid with a laptop can have a multi-track amazing recording studio. You know, I feel like that because they don't have to struggle with four tracks, they don't get that experience of learning the basics. So, but I started on the cassette recorder, and then I graduated up to a reel-to-reel analog machine, which was awesome, and it was so much fun. And the thing about analog is it's, from my understanding, a chemical process of transferring the sound to the tape. And it's sort of like this weird, magical, archaic chemical transfer or oxidation or,
You're putting magnetic information on tape.
Exactly. And it's really, really magical how that happens. And I recorded like that, and I recorded like that for quite some time. For maybe 6 years, I was strictly analog, and I loved it. And then I think in 1998, I got my first Mac computer with Cubase, and it really changed the way I did everything. And, the difference there with the analog process, theoretically, what you're getting is what you put into an analog recording device is what you get out of it. It's an analog, meaning it's an exact copy of what you put into it. But because, there are some flaws in the technology, and the flaws are there's a higher noise floor usually, meaning, you can get more hiss on your recordings, especially when you, re-record or keep overdubbing or bouncing. Say I only have 16 tracks to work with. See, on tape decks, you had a fixed amount of tracks, and you can have 16 different things playing simultaneously. That's what tracks are. And there was a fixed amount depending on your tape machine. So if I had 16 tracks and say I wanted to do like a crazy Queen-sounding background vocal thing where I was triple tracking, and triple tracking is when you – so if I sing something and I sing it and I do like a three-part harmony, it's going to sound like three guys singing. And if I want it to sound like a choir, I want to keep doubling and doubling. So the ultimate thing is if you have a three-part harmony, which normally would be three guys singing, what you want to do is do each one of those parts three times, and that's called triple tracking. For example, the Beatles did double tracking. You can hear that a lot. Like, let me take you down, cause all those little every time it sounds like John is singing the song twice, that's double tracking. And then bands like Boston and Queen took it a step further by triple tracking, and that's where they got that really huge choir sound. But on an analog tape machine, that burns nine tracks, and then you only have seven tracks left over to do your drums, bass, guitar, keyboards, lead vocals. That's no good. So what you would do is you would take all nine tracks, you'd mix them as best as you could, and then record those nine onto another two tracks in stereo, and then you erase the other nine tracks you originally recorded just to make room. And if you did that over and over and over again, every time you did that, your recording would get noisier and noisier and noisier. So the noise, some people love the noise. I go back, I listen to old Yes records and Queen records, and the noise, I guess I'm more sensitive to it now. It's there, but it's not a deal breaker. Good music is good music. But the other limitations are, in order to edit on a tape deck, you have to get, a razor out and splice pieces of tape together, which is terrifying if you've never done it, because once you do that, it's done. It's very difficult to go back. So that sort of linear editing is it could be limiting. It's also – there's something sort of freeing about recording on analog, because once you record something, it's done. There's not – you're not going to go back and try to make it perfect. But moving forward, when I got my first digital workstation set up, it was definitely a learning curve, because what digital does now is you don't have a track limit anymore. Whereas I had a 16-track limit, you know, the Beatles recorded Sgt. Pepper on four tracks, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
Now, instead of having a 16-track limit, which I thought was pretty huge, I had infinite tracks, and the only limit was how fast my computer's processor was. So I could have a session open with 76 tracks if I wanted. And that's a good thing and a bad thing, because what happens is you're forced to make do with less. And I feel like sometimes as an artist, when you're forced to deal with restrictions and limitations, you end up becoming more creative and coming up with creative solutions. When you have a canvas that's infinite, you start saying, oh, let me add this triangle track. And then the song might not need a triangle track, but you feel like because it's there, you know, you can use it. And another really funny side thing here is one of the pioneers of multi-track recording was Les Paul. And I got to meet him once. I saw him do a gig in Manhattan. And everybody was talking to him about guitars and stuff after the – I think I was like 13 or 14 years old. And everyone was talking to him about guitars and music and, you know, jazz and whatever. And I went up to him after the show and I said, you know, I want to thank you, sir, for the multi-track recorder. And he said, oh, you're very welcome. He goes, but just remember, if you have an empty track, you don't have to fill it. That's what he said to me. And that's a really important lesson, especially now with computers when you can have infinite whatever you want. Sometimes you have to put limitations on yourself. But, I mean, and going back to limitations of digital, before I said analog is theoretically a perfect copy of what you put in. Digital, the way that works is the computer or the capture device, whatever you're using, it takes a digital snapshot of your audio. So it's not technically as smooth as analog. So for example, if you're listening to a CD, I don't know if anybody listens to CDs anymore, that is recorded at 16-bit and 44.1 kilohertz. So what that means is whatever your capture or conversion device is, it's taking a sound, say I'm playing my guitar, it's actually, instead of recording a continuous stream of audio, it's actually breaking my guitar down into, and it's doing it 44,100 times per second. And the amount of information each one of those samples holds is 16 bits. So now, can you really hear the difference? Some people can. I mean, I think CDs sound great, but you do lose something there. So what's been happening recently is the newer equipment and HD and all this stuff, that's been giving you higher and higher rates. So that 44,100 figure I gave you, that's called a sample rate. So now devices can do 192K. So it's, and supposedly the higher you go with this number, the more warmth and harmonic content you get back. So it's funny that how all this innovation with digital technology and people are trying to get it to sound like tape because there was something magical about tape. But another huge benefit to digital is that you have non-linear editing, meaning I can record my voice and cut it up 1,000 ways and make something completely new out of it. And that's something that's really difficult and probably impossible to do with a tape machine. And I can really do crazy amounts of editing. And now if you listen to all pop music, it's all perfect, completely edited. And whether you like that or not, that's subjective. But a lot of people say that because we have this ability to go in there and really cut things up and make things perfect, that the music has lost something. You know, when you go back, because you and I, David, before we – when we were corresponding via email, we were talking about our love of Yes. And mm-hmm. those Yes albums, even though Yes was one of the greatest bands ever, they're not perfect. There's plenty of little things in there you can hear. So, but that's why everybody's gone crazy with perfection. But, you know, it's very hard not to when you have the ability to do it.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the science and technology of rock and roll with Blue Oyster Cult's Richie Castellano. Stay with us. And we're back talking to Richie Castellano from Band Geek Podcast. He's also the guitar and bass player for Blue Oyster Cult.
Recently, you did a podcast on the gear Blue Oyster Cult uses for a concert, and I'd like to give our listeners a taste of that. Let's start with your guitar, and give us everything that goes with that.
Okay. My guitar is on, when I play on the road, I use a traditional electric guitar. It's an Ernie Ball Music Man, and that has humbucking pickups, which I believe is another innovation from Les Paul. So that technology is over 50 years old. And that goes into a very sophisticated device called a Helix, which in my mind really is the culmination of digital technology combining with guitar gear. For me, some guitarists, you got to understand, are kind of old school and are hesitant to embrace technology because, you know, guitarists like tubes. That, you know, what other field still uses tubes for power? It's crazy. But this device, the Helix, I run it directly into the PA system, meaning I don't need a speaker on stage. I don't have to mic the speaker. It's actually digitally recreates the sound of guitar amplifiers and effects pedals and a whole bunch of other things. And that's what I use to get my main sound.
Okay, I want to, this is where I want to have you play for us, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I listened to one of your pieces where it was one of the podcasts, and I listened to so many this weekend that I've lost track of what was what. But
well, thank you for that.
I thoroughly enjoyed it and highly recommend it to our listeners, and they can link to that on our website, mynspr.org. You'll be able to check all this stuff out. But what I'd like you to do is, could you do for us, like, for example, play like Brian May, make like Queen sound. Can you do that?
Yes, sir. Hold on one second. Right now I am playing my Line 6 Variax guitar, and this is a digital modeling guitar. So I have recreated Brian May's sound with this. So too. Make me sign two guitars. Brian May.
Very nice. Can you give us your best David Gilmour Pink Floyd guitar tone?
Hold on one second. I had to retune. Yes, I can do that. Okay. Let's see if this works. Yep.
Dave, can you sing over this?
No, I'm not going to go there.
Dave teaches high school, so for him to sing, "We Don't Need No Education," might put him out of a job.
Yes, yeah, your students will sample that real quick.
could you? Give me another one of your favorite artists, and maybe some a riff in like their styles. You tell us what you'd like to do.
Oh, here's one. We just had our Band Geek live show.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a song we did. And at the end of that solo, there's this really awesome harmony thing that goes like this. Steve Lukather for you.
Let's talk about your podcast, the Band Geek Podcast, which is, I highly recommend. All of the covers and things that you guys do on there are just so much fun. If you love rock music, I highly recommend them, and you can link them to them from our website, mynspr.org. I was really impressed by the Yes covers you did. You're really skilled musicians, but you made comments about how difficult it was to do. You did Heart of the Sunrise and The Calling, right? From Talk. Tell us about how difficult those were.
Well, Heart of the Sunrise is like a typical prog rock masterpiece song in that it's 10 minutes long and it has a lot of different movements to it and a lot of sections that, you know, that it goes through odd time signatures, and it's sort of like a very cut and paste sort of arrangement. And it's difficult to play. But the thing about it is the group of guys that I did it with were the guys that I mentioned before who I turned on to Yes when we were in high school. So it was, you know, for us, it was just like when you play a video game that you didn't play for 10 years or something. It's like, oh, it just all came back to us. So that actually wasn't the harder song. Even though that song is very difficult to play, we just had the advantage of, you know, having played it for the last 15 or so years and just knowing it. The Calling was really difficult because that is more of a production-oriented song. And where Heart of the Sunrise, if you speed up a little bit, if you play something maybe a little rushed, and if a line's a little sloppy, it's not really going to ruin the whole song. You know what I mean? If the song's going to – the integrity of the song is just compositionally the whole piece and the sum of the parts coming together. With The Calling, it's a very intricately produced and precise performance. So that is almost like when you play The Calling – When we were playing Heart of the Sunrise, we felt like high school kids, and it was a lot of fun. When we were playing The Calling, we put on our session musician hats and tried to play as, you know, precisely as possible. And another interesting thing about The Calling is that that was, I believe, the first rock album to ever be recorded inside a computer.
Tell us about your friends and Band Geek podcast and the music that you do together, because it is so fun.
A lot of performers have this sort of personality thing where you listen to something and you go, I could do that. I had a day job for a while where I was commuting an hour each way, and I found that podcasts were the best thing to keep me awake while I was making a long drive. So I started listening to a bunch of podcasts, and, you know, of course I was like, I could totally do this. And I'd been on a podcast before, this podcast called The Hole on Riotcast. It's a very raunchy, like, you know, almost like shock jock sort of show. And I reached out to them. I said, you know, I kind of want to do a podcast. And they said, you know, we were going to ask you to do one anyway. So now I'm on this really like raunchy comedy network called Riotcast. And I honestly sometimes don't know what I'm doing there because our show is so different than everything else. But the thing about our show that really sets it apart from other music shows is I liked, did you ever see the show Live from Daryl's House?
Yes.
I like that show a lot. What I tried to imagine is like, what would Live from Daryl's House be with me and all my goofball friends? Like, what would that be? Like, how Daryl and his band, they're all like the greatest musicians in the world, and they get through songs and they look so cool, and they're just, and everybody's just chilling. It's like us, like, I want to sound like Daryl's band, but I wanted us to be us. I wanted us to not be superhuman rock stars, because we're not. We're just people who enjoy music and we think things are funny and we like, you know, other things. So it's just sort of like the weird, bizarro, silly version of Live from Daryl's House, where we're not afraid to make fun of ourselves to the point where we will ritualistically replace saxophone solos with kazoo solos because it makes us giggle. And we'll have a cover of a song that's completely spot on, except instead of this saxophone solo, there'll be a really horrid sounding kazoo solo. And that's funny to us. And apparently that's funny to other people too. We just try to do things that make us smile and make us laugh. And that's the only criteria we have for the show, pretty much. And it's co-hosted with my longtime friend, Jarrett Pressman, who is a Second City trained comedian who also sings. He's got, you know, great karaoke chops, and he's our kazoo player. And then later on, we got in Andy Escalise, who is my longtime collaborator, who can play almost any instrument.
Phenomenally talented.
Yeah. And he can play almost any instrument on a professional level, which is impressive and infuriating. And then we got my wife, Anne-Marie, who is the greatest singer I know and also plays piano and bass. So once we started getting that together and putting out this product, and, you know, a lot of people started noticing and wanting to be involved. And that's the greatest thing, is I got to meet certain people through the podcast, and they, you know, or can reconnect with musicians I haven't played with in decades, who just come down here because they want to have fun with us. It's, you know, people don't get paid to play on the podcast. They come down because they love music. and they want to hang out with us and have a good time and be able to watch that on YouTube. And that's our main goal. And another thing I always say is I want everybody to be happy about coming on the show. I want everybody to leave here knowing they had a good time and knowing that, you know, they're going to be represented well. And that's something I tell all the guests. I said, look, if you want to stop and do something again, let's do it again. I mean, most of the time when you hear these videos, you're not hearing the first take. You might be hearing the seventh take. You know what I mean? Because we want to make sure everybody's comfortable and happy. And sometimes it's really frustrating when we're down here because we'll be down here recording a 90-minute podcast that it might take us 4 hours because, you know, we do a little rehearsal of the music and we just want to get it right to where we're all happy with it and we're all proud of it. And I think that shows.
Well, as much as I hate to say this, we need to let you go. So it's time for our encore. You know, it's time for you to come out and play Roundabout before you leave. I'm ready to rock out and go home. You know what? It was so fun talking to you today.
Thank you for having me on. This was a blast.
Well, I appreciate you being on and educating me a little bit about all this stuff that I find so fascinating. And highly recommend to our listeners, check out Band Geek Podcast. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, if your listeners want to see more about the stuff I was talking about today, they can check out my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/RichieCastellano. And I have all these videos with links to all this crazy digital stuff I'm doing now.
And we'll put all that on our website.
Oh, wonderful.
Thanks to Richie Castellano from Blue Oyster Cult and Band Geek Podcast. You can listen to this and past programs at mynspr.org. Follow us on Twitter at @NSPRNews and me at Dave Shlom. For the man who shreds it every day, Nolan Ford, I'm Dave Shlom, reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.